Session number 26581.
Group Captain Eccles, Rail 11. We're talking about lectures from possibly Montgomery Hyde. You're not quite sure about his name, but he was... historians can look him up and see who he is. About the threat of communism. He said that after the war, they've been told to join the electrical union or electricians union.
Well, yes, the group of the Communist Party of the Great Britain that had gone underground penetrated the electrical trade union. But they made two mistakes. The first was they penetrated at the top level, and actually the president didn't have that much power or authority. And secondly, they did it by illegal means, and there was a famous court case, and the man was thrown out. So they had to start again. And in the second time, they decided, well, as Britain had to export to live, and as the motor industry was the largest part of British exports, they would penetrate the motor industry, transport, and the docks at shop steward level. And this they did. And in this they were absolutely and completely successful. And eventually, the British Leyland in 1974 crashed, and they had won.
And I know you made a recording with History Workshop about your later involvement in this, which we'll leave to one side. Now, anything else about the course? How did the syndicates operate? I mean, how did your syndicate operate? Because you were meant to work together, weren't you?
Yes, the written work that the students had to do were, from what I can remember, directly concerned with the exercises that were going on. There may be an exercise in writing an appreciation of a situation that was given to them. It may be that they had to come up with some recommended courses of action and so on. Or they may have to do straightforward administrative exercises in which they were to write letters on certain subjects to certain people, and it was the job of the student to see that these letters were written clearly, concisely, and unambiguously. In fact, as all their written work should be. And it was then, after the written work was finished by fixed deadlines, then the syndicate leader, the member of the DS, would take all that written work and go through it and mark it up with comments and so on, and then return it to the students.
So the syndicates didn't operate in the way they did in the Army Staff College of solving a problem, working to solve a problem together?
Oh, yes. A lot of the exercises will be working as a group. These were exercises of a kind of operational nature. The individual exercises were much more of a staff officer's activity. The operational nature would be, well, some of them, in fact, were joint exercises with the Army Staff College at Camberley or with the Navy at Greenwich.
What type, do you remember any of them in particular? What sort of thing they were like?
Well, I can remember that one of the Army ones was connected with the need for the RAF to fly reinforcements out to an activity where there was limited war going on, and the RAF had to provide the necessary aircraft and the flight schedules and turnaround times and everything else so as to be able to produce on the ground the personnel and equipment that the Army wanted.
And how did you do? Did you feel that, or how were you assessed?
I beg your pardon?
How were you assessed at the college?
I really can't remember. It wasn't a question of an assessment on whether you passed or failed exams. It was an assessment of the syndicate leader giving an overall assessment of each of his students from what he thought of them, from the work that they had done for him. I have a feeling, too, that syndicates changed. You didn't have the same syndicate throughout the entire course.
But you did all right.
Yes. And of course, another thing in the course was making visits. We visited the bomb damage in Germany, particularly in Berlin. We went aboard a carrier and saw demonstrations of fleet air arm activities. We visited Bovingdon and saw tanks in operation. So we got some idea from these visits, and we also visited aircraft industry, of a background to what was going on elsewhere.
Now, you were there from January 51 to, well, through to January 52, basically.
Yes, it was a 12-month course.
And what was your next?
I was then posted as the officer commanding number 210 squadron in Coastal Command.
Now, before you had to do that, you had to go on a couple of refresher courses, neither of which were particularly long. The first one seems to have been a flying course with number 101 FRS.
Yes, that was a flying refresher school. And you see, I hadn't been doing any flying, really, since the end of the war. Only just the odd bits of here and there. So I had to get back into training again. And that was the purpose of the flying refresher school.
Now, had anything changed? That was at Finningley, RAF Finningley. That was January 52 through to March 52. So just a sort of three
well,
months.
There had been a big change, in the sense that flying discipline was tightened up. There had been, obviously, for obvious reasons, a lessening of flying discipline during the war. And so after the war, it became necessary to have a much tighter discipline, and pilots had to become qualified in their ability to fly, first of all, just to be able to fly, and secondly, to be able to fly on instruments, and thirdly, to be capable of being an advanced pilot. This meant that the first part, which was a white rating, meant that you could only fly when you were authorised to do so. The second one also meant you could only fly when authorised to do so by your flight commander. And the third one, the master instrument rating, meant you could fly on your own authority.
This, you were graded on this? At the
so therefore, you then had to go through instrument rating tests in order to qualify, and these had to be renewed every 6 months.
And so you'd have to take a test, but essentially every 6 months?
Yes. And you had to be re-rated. If you were on a different type of aircraft, you had to be re-rated for that aircraft.
And were there any new aircraft? I mean, what were you learning to fly it?
Well, at Finningley, I was just flying Wellingtons. But then the squadron, number 210 squadron at that time, was operating Lancaster aircraft based at St. Evel. And I went up to the Coastal Command Operational Training Unit at Kinloss.
Now, hang on, before that, you went to the School of Maritime Reconnaissance.
Oh, yes, that's right.
Sorry yeah. to...
That's okay.
I've got
no,
that.
That's right,
yeah, yeah. It's not my memory's better. No. I've got this written down in front of me.
And after the refresher flying course at Finningley, I then did a refresher general reconnaissance course at the Maritime Reconnaissance School at St. Morgan.
And was there anything new here? Because
No. As far as that was concerned, it was a straightforward refresher, and I was never really bothered about anything because I wasn't learning anything I didn't know already.
And the final thing was you went to in June you went to number 236 OCU.
Yes.
Operational Conversion Unit. Or
that's right. This was the Coastal Command conversion unit at Kinloss, which was training people to fly Shackleton aircraft, which were the new aircraft coming into Coastal Command. It so happened that after completing the Shackleton course and going back to 210 Squadron on Lancasters, we then converted to Neptune aircraft and not to Shackleton's.
Now, what, just as it passes by, so to speak, what did you think of the Shackleton as an aircraft, because that was going to be an important aircraft. Or was an important aircraft.
Well, actually, at the time, I was converted to Shackleton, so I was quite happy. I'd been flying Lancasters. I'd sort of unofficially converted to Lancasters on 210 Squadron. And the Shackleton was a rather much improved Lancaster. It was a very noisy aeroplane because it had contraprop propellers, and the particular engines in these aircraft and these contraprops made a lot of noise in the aircraft and a lot of vibration. In fact, people used to say that if you flew for 10 hours, you had 10 hours afterwards of vibration with you.
So the next thing, you go, finally in August 52, you go to be officer commanding, the squadron leader in command of 210 Squadron, a coastal command squadron, at St. Devil in Cornwall.
Yes.
Now, what were your first, you know, when you join a unit, and especially as you join as a commanding officer, you're sort of taking over what's going to be your life for quite a while, and what were your first impressions of the state of the unit?
Well, I had been at St. Devil during the war, and so it was, there was nothing strange to me about it, and during the course of my service life, I'd gone from one unit to another sufficiently frequently that I never even thought about what things were going to be like. It was just, I had a very good idea, and they always turned out to be just that.
I think what I meant was, how did you assess the state of the unit in the sense of its good and bad points, and what you wanted to do as CNC to correct or to carry on? Do you see what I mean?
Yes, well, actually, I mentioned the fact that there had been a tightening up of discipline from a flying point of view of the instrument rating tests. Well, Coastal Command in peacetime had also had to develop some form of control of what the units were doing. So they had a continual training program going on, and it was our job simply to carry out the training exercises that were allotted.
So it was really just not that big a... you didn't have to sort of go in and sort anything particularly major out?
No, not at all. It carried on in a routine manner.
Was it the same organisation as when you left it? You know, when you'd served?
Well, there had been a change in the organisation of the Royal Air Force in operating aircraft. And there'd also been a change in, because I suppose for reasons of economy, the wartime squadron commanded by a wing commander with some 20 aircraft was now a squadron of 6 aircraft commanded by a squadron leader, and it only had one flight. The method of servicing aircraft, which previously had been entirely a matter of what was called first line and second line servicing carried out by squadron personnel and third line servicing by the station, was changed. And the squadrons only did first line servicing and the station did everything else, with the result that the manpower of a squadron was considerably reduced, so that in fact number 210 Squadron, where I commanded it, was probably less than 100 people altogether.
Now, and when you joined them, they were flying
Lancasters at St. Devil, and just after I arrived, one of our annual NATO maritime exercises started, and we were to be deployed to RAF Ballykelly in Northern Ireland for the exercise. And I suggested to a group, because we were moving to Topcliffe, that instead of coming back to St. Neville after the exercise, we went straight to Topcliffe, and this was agreed. So actually the time at St. Neville was pretty short. We went to the exercise at Ballykelly.
Now tell me about that exercise. What exactly were you doing?
There were two main exercises that went on whilst I was with 210 Squadron, and I can't remember which was which. I think this one was called Main Brace, and the other one was Mariner. But in this particular exercise, the Orange Force in other words, the theoretical enemy force, was the American nuclear submarine fleet. And the blue force, which was the Allied force, was the U.S. Atlantic Navy and the Royal Navy all operating together as a joint task force. And the job of the Coastal Command aircraft was to give air escort to this task force in order to prevent the submarine attack. In fact, it was a pretty negative affair because the American nuclear submarines were not a difference in degree of submarines, but a complete change of kind. A nuclear submarine is so different in its ability to perform submerged that it bears no resemblance to the U-boats that we knew. A nuclear submarine submerged can do a speed such that it can keep up with an aircraft carrier. In fact, I believe that during the course of this exercise, a nuclear submarine was underneath a carrier for quite a few hours and nobody knew it was there. This main brace showed, if it ever needed to be shown, that in fact the threat of a nuclear submarine was something that was going to be extremely difficult to counter.
So, anything else about the exercise, or you were just flying patrols round the
yes,
which you've done in the Second World War?
Yes, absolutely. There's no difference.
Same kind of patterns?
Yes, they were just the same exercises as before. I think possibly there were some British submarines involved which were not nuclear, and they had the snorkel device, which gave us the opportunity of seeing something of an orange force. The exercise itself had no specific anecdotes, but there was one very definite one concerning the move from Ballykelly to Topcliffe. RAF Topcliffe at that time was a transport command station, and our move to it was that it was changing from being a transport station to a coastal command station. At the end of exercise main brace, we only had, if I remember, three aircraft. I can't remember why it was only three, probably because we were in the process of re-equipping later on. But anyway, we had three aircraft in the exercise, and we loaded these up with ground equipment and certain ground crew, and off they went to deposit the load at Topcliffe. But when they asked for landing instructions, air traffic control said that denied permission to land, and said the aircraft were to return to Ballykelly on the instructions of their station commander. So whilst I was waiting back at Ballykelly for these aircraft to return empty for me to take the rest of everything and myself, I was surprised that they were still fully loaded. It so happened that a Hastings aircraft from Topcliffe was at Ballykelly and about to return to Topcliffe empty. So it was no difficulty to load everything into the Hastings, and our ground crew, ground equipment, everything. And consequently, we arrived, as we had intended, at Topcliffe. Next morning, I reported into the station commander's make my number, and his adjutant, who was a WAF officer, said to me, had I got an appointment? And I said, no, I had only just arrived with my unit on the station. And she said, well, I'll see if the station commander will see you. And she went into the inner office, and I could hear voices slightly raised. And she came out and said, the station commander will see you. And I went in to see him. And he said, how dare you arrive on this station without my authority? And I pointed out to him that I was acting under instructions, that the squadron was being permanently moved to Topcliff, and that Topcliff, as far as I was concerned, was now becoming a coastal command station. We never saw eye to eye for the whole of the time that he and I were on the station together.
Did it make things difficult, having problems with your relationship with the station commander? I mean, you know...
Well, I don't like to speak ill of the dead, but actually he became a bit of a laughingstock. There was another incident. At the time we arrived at Topcliff, there were two Hastings squadrons of Transport Command there, and after a week or two, they moved on to some other station. And we had a guest night the night before they were leaving. And the station commander had made it clear, he said, this is a guest night, and I have a guest, and there are to be no speeches. And at the end of the dinner, in the usual way, the gavel was sounded, and his guest got up and went off to the anteroom, and nobody else did. And we all sat down again, and then had a whole series of speeches and great jollity, and everything went on for half an hour, an hour. And the station commander and his guest were left alone in the anteroom. Next morning, the station commander sent for me and was furious. I said there were to be no speeches. And I said that as far as number 210 squadron was concerned, there had been no speeches. If I remember rightly, there had been some speeches given by members of the Hastings squadron, which had now left the station. Again, we never saw eye to eye.
Now, what was your actual role when you were, at Topcliff? I mean, we'll look at that rather than St. Evel, because you weren't there long. Yeah. What were you actually doing day to day? What was the role of the squadron?
Well, the role of the squadron, there were three coastal command squadrons at Topcliff, we had been converted to Neptune aircraft. I'd gone back to Kinloss over Christmas time and done the Neptune conversion course.
Now tell me about the Neptune. Give me a picture, because I'm very unfamiliar with the Neptune.
Well, the Neptune, to me, was the very latest form of Hudson. It couldn't be improved. It was a beautiful aeroplane in every way. It was interesting because it was a twin-engine aircraft. Now, amongst my crews in 210 Squadron at that time were people who had been flying Lancasters and had been brought up on four-engine aircraft and weren't at all happy with the idea of flying two-engine aircraft out over the middle of the Atlantic. Whilst as far as I was concerned, it was never a problem at all. I'd always been happy in a twin-engine aircraft. But the equipment of the Neptune was far in advance of anything that the Shackleton had. And it was a very, very comfortable aeroplane to fly. And it was beautifully appointed.
Did you have any new navigational devices? I mean, I'm thinking, because you'd had so much of a problem, we haven't really talked about it.
Our navigational facilities were, of course, vastly improved. We had a radar that was so much improved over anything we'd known before that you could, as I proved on an exercise when we went to Malta, we could follow the periscope of a submarine up to 20 miles away, which was totally unheard of with our wartime radar equipment. We also had an attack radar, and the attack radar was tied into the searchlight that was fitted, which had been, the idea of searchlights had been developed by the RAF in Coastal Command Wellingtons during the war, and this had been taken to the nth degree, and the searchlights were tied into the radar so that when we onto the attack radar, so that when we homed into a target, the drift that was set up was automatically transmitted to the searchlight, so the searchlight was automatically set to allow for the drift. And I, on one occasion, on a minor exercise in the Channel, I had with me a journalist from the Flight magazine, and I demonstrated to him this attack radar. It was a pitch dark night, and there was a frigate that we were operating with. And I, again, we had a radio altimeters, which we never had in Hudson's. And I came down to 50 feet in total darkness and homed onto this target. And as the radar, attack radar operator was calling out the range of the target, at 500 feet, I pressed the button and lit up the searchlight, which illuminated the bridge of the frigate and nothing else. And we then, climbed rapidly over the frigate. The journalist was duly impressed.
You mentioned the radar altimeter. How did?
Well, the radar altimeter was a very simple device, a radio device that simply got a reflection from the surface and was able to measure your height above ground. And the radio altimeter is a standard piece of equipment in all aircraft today.
But that was much more accurate than the...
Well,
what did you
before
have
that,
barometric?
We had a barometric one, and unless you actually had the exact barometric pressure at the point where you were descending, you were inclined to be rather out of the height or above the sea that you thought you were.
Now, what about other navigational? You mentioned a navigational radar, but what about any type of geopositional things?
That hadn't come into being by that time. I can't remember. We had a very good radio compass, and of course, in peacetime, there were nothing like the restrictions on commercial radio transmitters. So there were plenty of sources of radio transmission to work with.
Now, so what exactly were you doing in? I mean, were you patrolling, or was there anything to patrol for? I mean, would you?
Well, the work that we did in peacetime was following out a lot of set routine exercises, the kind of curriculum issued by Coastal Command, and it was also an exercise, 2 weeks. Detachment to Malta, which squadrons took in turn, and it called Exercise Fair Isle, where we went down to Malta and cooperated in submarine exercises with the Navy.
And what were those exercises like? What do you remember of that?
Well, they were exercises of going out and searching for a submarine in a given position and locating it and attacking it with a sea marker or something like that, a small practice bomb, which when it went off, the people inside the submarine would be able to gauge whether it was to them a hit or not a hit. It was a good exercise in cooperation with the Navy. We would take them up with us, at least those of who volunteered to do so, and they would take us in a submarine. Strangely enough, there were far more RAF volunteered to go in submarines than there were Navy who volunteered to go in aircraft.